Hello again and welcome to another edition of the AFC Wimbledon podcast. I'm Mike T of Radio WDN and I follow. And if you're anything like me, you'll still be recovering from this.
Back now to Reeves once again, dead high and forward. Brown now with the opportunity. Blair's going up in the centre. Oh, and it's a chance for Curtis. It's a goal! For Wimbledon! Yes! Yes! It's Rhoda Curtis!
There you go, what a truly legendary afternoon that was. But in the midst of those somewhat raucous celebrations, your regular host Aaron Paul has only gone and lost his voice. So I'll be filling you in on what's to come in this week's episode. First up, we speak with women's team general manager Sophia Axelsson ahead of International Women's Day.
We want young girls and women to feel at home here. It's not just a football club. This is their community. It's their home.
And then the wild thing returns. Yes, indeed. Gareth Ainsworth visits us here at the Lane and, amongst other things, fills us in on some of the more unconventional methods of curing a groin problem.
This guy then puts me in the chair. I don't think there's much sort of sterilisation here anyway. But what he picks up from the side of the table is what I can only say is a pair of pliers.
Anyway, that's all to come. But first up, let's hear from women's team general manager Sophia Axelsson in conversation with Aaron.
Sophia, great to talk to you ahead of International Women's Day. You are a very familiar face around the Cherry Road Record Stadium, but just tell us about your role or the variety of roles you play here at this football club.
So, as in my role as Women's General Manager, I tend to deal with everything that is outside of the football pitch. So I have nothing to do with the team selection or the players that we bring in. That's all the manager, Kevin Foster. But anything else, whether that's ordering kit, commercial deals, budgeting alongside the board, growth in terms of both social media and the attendances, and being kind of that link between the club and like the men's side and the women's side being based here at the ground.
Tell me about the role that women play at our football club, because there are so many huge characters here. But sometimes, I mean, do you feel they're overlooked?
I think maybe they're not as visible. I don't think they're overlooked internally. I think we're quite good at celebrating successes, no matter who they are. But we have some great characters, and we have had some great characters, women in and around the club for a long time since it started. And just yesterday, I was on a panel with three other women in a Wales event. We had Michelle Little, who's obviously the Don's Trust chair at the moment. We had Luke Carton Kelly, who was one of the founding chairs of Don's Trust, and also Jenny Scott, who's currently the chair of the Foundation Trustees. So there's certainly so many inspiring women in and around the club that we that maybe are not as visible, but do so much for this club.
Tell me about the Wowza event. It was broadcast online. You had a good turnout, the first, hopefully, of many Wowza meetings. What did you take from it, and what do you hope people took from it?
I think I took that... Oh, God, is that going to really...
No.
Okay. I think I took that that maybe we need to be actively more visible with the women in and around the club, but also because there are so many inspiring stories and so many people that play such a big part in making this club the success that it is. I think that was my main takeaway.
Tell me about some of the characters we see in and around our football club. You talk about Lou Carton Kelly. We know about her role in WISA, in building AFC Wimbledon and in pushing AFC Wimbledon. She's a supporter with a big character. We see her on match days doing her thing. You look at other people, Jane Lonsdale, who's been heavily involved, Michelle Little. I think of people outside the club. I think of Maureen Batsford and Elizabeth Beresford as well. Elizabeth Beresford, of course, of the Wombles. This club has had some powerful women represent it and powerful women pushing it as well.
Absolutely. Completely agree with that. And I think that's continuing now. And having Women Supporters Associations highlighting those women as well is just helping a lot to make sure that they are visible.
The FA and Kicking Out have released figures today talking about misogyny and abuse and how rates of it are going up. What needs to be done on a bigger scale to bring those numbers down?
I think it's a collective responsibility to make a change, because it's not just in football, is it? It's a societal thing where a lot of people take an awful lot of space, and if women encroach on their spaces, on men's spaces, there can be a lot of backlash from that. But football, just like the rest of the world, is there for everyone. It's a sport for everyone. So I think we need to take a collective responsibility to call these things out when we see them, and consider the words that we use when we talk about players on the pitch, people in the crowds, and that's on everyone's responsibility.
Tell me more about how we're making Plough Lane a more inclusive place for women and for everyone in general.
I think we definitely are. I think the foundation do an awful lot of work in making sure that it's inclusive for young people, that it's a safe space, that the layout of the stadium really helps. It doesn't feel as tight, as small as many other stadiums feel. The kind of concourse areas that we've got, where you can be separate from other people but be part of this big occasion, this big theatre that football is, certainly helps. And there are people within the club that work a lot with Edie and I, like Mandy Bynum is like Edie and I lead at the club. We have meetings together to think about ways that we can encourage conversation and encourage and highlight various courses throughout the season. And we try to do that as a joint venture, not just the men's side or not just the foundation or the women, but all together.
If you were to give a message to a young lady who maybe was thinking about coming to watch football here at Wimbledon but was unsure, or maybe someone who wanted to play football and was looking at the women's team thinking, hey, maybe I could pull on the yellow and blue one day, what would you say to them to welcome them in and make them feel like, yes, Wimbledon is an inclusive place and you can find a home here?
I think, personally, that's kind of the first encounter that you get at Wimbledon is welcoming, no matter where you which way you come. If you come to a women's match day here, we have really welcoming, encouraging volunteers that are here to help, or match day ambassadors, or whatever you want to call them. But it's the same at the men's match day, whether you come in via reception or the shop or through the turnstiles, there's always someone there to kind of welcome you here. And in terms of playing, we know that I think it's over 200% more girls and women that partaking in foundation activities, for example, and we certainly see those numbers in people wanting to reach out and play for the team as well. And there are so many different ways that you can get involved in football, whether you are from a young age taking part in our girls' pathway, which we hope will then lead to successes within the women's first team, to recreational football or even walking football with the foundation as well. So there are so many different ways that you can get involved here in whatever capacity you want.
As far as our work with regards to ED&I and inclusion continues, how does this club do more, and do we have any bigger plans in the future?
I think I hope that we have bigger plans. I think there's always more that you can do, more to show people from any background or women or support for the LGBTQ+ community. And there's always more that we can do. And I think the more we work together, the stronger our base is here, the more we can work together to expand on that as well. I think we're fairly settled here back home again now. So now we can just work on growing that in every way, not just crowd numbers, but also our the community aspect and the kind of representation of that as well. We want young girls and women to feel at home here. It's not just a football club. This is their community. It's their home.
When we look at the women's team this year, led by Kevin Foster, off the pitch led by Kevin Foster and yourself, but on the pitch led by some remarkable players, really geared up for potential success this season, aren't we?
Yeah, currently top of the league. We have had some great games, and so far this year, since after Christmas, we've just been firing on all cylinders and winning games with big scores. And it's turning into a very interesting end of the season and a hopeful promotion to Tier 3.
What would promotion to Tier 3 mean for the players, the infrastructure, the football club? I know we've been waiting for a long time, it feels like, to be promoted, and we've always kind of like been the near miss team. But what would it mean for you guys?
I think recognition for the hard work that they've done, that everyone's done. Like Kevin has been part of the club for about 10 years. Hannah, our captain, has been part of the team. This is her eighth season. And they've put in so much into this team. And we've built a really special group here. And I think that's a testament to that, would mean that. And obviously for next season, that would mean bigger journeys, bigger teams, hopefully bigger crowds, and a step closer to being even more professional.
The women's side have played here at Plough Lane. What are their thoughts of playing here? Do they enjoy it? Do they prefer playing at Carr Short? Where do they prefer being?
This is our home. This is where we want to be. And it certainly helps our numbers as well. Last time we played here against Cambridge United, we had our record crowd then of 1,410. And that's the biggest crowd that we've had. Whereas when we play down in Carshalton, which is not our catchment area, which is not Wimbledon, we get maybe about 200. So this makes a massive difference. And you can see that in the way that they play as well.
In terms of, again, I'm just kind of repeat the same question as before, but in terms of young women wanted to play for this football club, what's the pathway like? How can we get more young women coming down to watch, hopefully, their heroes?
Yeah, we're actually today announcing the trials and everything for the next season for the girls' pathway, and we're working all now together, the club, the women's team, foundation coaches, to make sure that the new girls' pathway, or not new, but the kind of new for next season pathway, will be a success that will then lead to playing, hopefully, in the women's first team.
Thanks, Sophia. And now on the pod, it's time to welcome a special guest, as former Dons winger Gareth Ainsworth sits down with Aaron Paul.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the official AFC Wimbledon podcast, coming to you from a miserable grey Plough Lane. Rain absolutely tipping down, but our guest is going to be bringing us a ray of sunshine this afternoon. Really buzzing for this episode and delighted to bring on someone who was at Wimbledon for five seasons, featuring in just 45 games. He left a big impact with his tenacity, hard work, and in recent years has defied age with his rugged, handsome looks. Ever the rock star, our guest will go on to forge a career in management, seeing him become an EFL icon. But we're here to talk about his days with us at the Dons. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Wild Thing, Gareth Ainsworth.
Thank you very much. There's a lot in there, considering I only played a few games for this club. Like, gutted. One of my biggest regrets. I'm sure we'll come on to it. But yeah, it was a brilliant time in my career, you know, the pinnacle, really, of Premier League. But it was a nice intro, that, Aaron. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. How are you? You're looking well.
I'm good, yeah. Well rested, unfortunately. It's obviously been 3 months now since I left QPR, you know, November, December, January and February, nearly 4 months. So tough times, tough club, you know, and obviously to look back and reflection on that, it's great. Still wouldn't change. Still, people say to me, come up to me now and go, oh, do you regret leaving Wickham and going QPR? No, do I? And do you want Wickham to do bad and QPR to do bad now? No, I want both teams to do unbelievable, because they're both part of my life and big part of, you know, my heart. But It was a tough season. That you know, I was truly frazzled at the end of last season, keeping them up, and this season, yeah, dropping into the bottom three wasn't fun. But No, I'm well rested now and looking for the next opportunity. But yeah, really, really pleased to be here and looking out on this fantastic pitch. You know, and it's it brings back some great memories. Although I never did play at Plough Lane, played here in a charity game.
Yeah,
recently. Yeah. The end of last season, scored a couple of goals at that end as well, I think. So yeah, I'm not sure the opposition was of great calibre, but I never played here as a professional. It's a brilliant stadium, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of great games here to come, you know.
Let's get straight into it. Looking at your career, it took you to a lot of places. For anyone who doesn't know, you are the epitome of the Blackburn boy.
Yeah.
But you had to kickstart your career somewhere else.
Yeah. I signed for Blackburn, so my story is different to what you'll find nowadays. I was never a schoolboy anyway, and I thought I'd missed the boat. I really did. I thought I was a decent player. I was quite shy when I went to secondary school, believe it or not, and never really got in the first team, the football team, until about third year. So what we're talking now, that'd be year nine probably now, in modern currency. So got into the first team at the St. Augustine Secondary School, where David Dunn actually went, named up in there, but he went there about 10 years after me. But and then Blackburn Rovers saw me playing for a Sunday team, and these days don't happen anymore. They just said, do you want to come down for a trial? Went down to Blackburn Rovers for a trial, scored a hat-trick in my trial game. Unbelievable. David May was playing in the game, and Jason Wilcox in the same team. And yeah, they offered me a two-year scholarship, but on my 18th birthday, they told me, you're not going to be a footballer. So I got to 18, so that was 16, left school. 2 years at Blackburn, 18 years old. World collapsed because Blackburn Rovers, my team, my season ticket team, just said, no, you're not going to make it, Don Mackay. So I went to Preston North End on trial and eventually signed for a team called Northwich Victoria. Well, I didn't actually sign. Which again wouldn't happen nowadays. I turned up and my dad, Bill, who's been with me my whole career, like, he never had an agent, but he was the closest thing. He said, don't sign. Sammy McElroy was the manager, legend of Man United, and he was desperate to sign me at Northwich, but my dad gave me the best advice. We didn't sign a contract.
Why?
Yeah, because it would have tied me. And my dad said, look, you'll make it back in the league. And that's probably my first recollection of me building up a bit of resilience, but I had good people around me doing it saying, I think you're good enough, you know. And it's me dad, and you're thinking, is he saying it because it's me dad and he's got to say that, or is he truly believe it? But he was a decent player himself, and he said, look, you'll make it, don't sign a contract because I believe someone will come back in for you in the league. Preston ironically came back and said, look, we've seen you, kept tabs on you, you've done well, come and sign for 6 months for us. And so I made my debut in 1991 at Gay Meadow in Shrewsbury, away at Shrewsbury, got a beat 2-1. But if you ask any professional footballer, that this is a momentous moment, your debut. Mm. You know, all you ever want to do is play in front of a crowd, play professional football. I was a pro. I'd played a professional game, so you consider yourself a pro. And yeah, at the end of that season, released again. But by that time, I'd had enough league games under my belt for a scout to take me to Cambridge United.
You go from Northwich to Preston, then to Cambridge, then back to Preston via Northwich. And then you follow John Beck to Lincoln. Tell us about his influence in your career.
Yeah, well, John was the manager at Cambridge. When this scout rang me up, Glenn Benelli, rang me up and said, look, John Beck, he'll love you. He'll love the way you play. So I went down to John Beck at Cambridge, made my championship debut. Cambridge were a championship team then, and scored on my debut, a header at the back post. I always remember it. And then John got the sack not long after, and he got the Preston job. So he took me back to Preston. So this is now becoming an incestuous sort of Preston North End sort of career, this, because it was Preston trial, Northwich, Preston contract, Cambridge, back to Preston. And John got the Preston job, took me back there, and really I started forging my career there. And then again, John got the sack. He went to Lincoln, and I was one of his first signings. And really, by this time, all the words he told me at Cambridge, he signed me at Cambridge, he said, I'll make you £1 million player. And I have to say that he came true on them words, because, you know, I did get sold for a couple of million to this club, to Wimbledon, you know, back in the day. But he got the best out of me. He's unbelievable at working on my strengths, working on what I was good at, not working on what I was bad at. He used to say to me, look, he said, why would I work on what you're bad at? We're going to make what you're good at even better. You're going to be the best at that. He said, because, you know, I'll be able to get your bad things, maybe average, but I'll be able to get your good things, super. And he said, and that's what will get you forward. And I've always kept that with me. So when people are struggling with something, they've all got the superpower, you know. And mine was taking fullbacks and getting crosses, and it really was. And he made the most of that. So I'll never forget him. He was brilliant.
You played a lot of football that season at Lincoln. It was...
Two seasons at Port Vale. Yeah, so... So I think Lincoln was about...
Sorry, three seasons at Lincoln.
Yeah.
You then went... Sorry,
two and a half, yeah.
John Beck to John Rudge.
To John Rudge.
John Rudge, well, Sir John Rudge, as they call him, at Port Vale. He signs you at Port Vale for £250,000. And you play a lot of football there. 55 games, 10 goals.
In a season, yeah.
In a season. Yeah. Did that knacker you out?
Do you know what? People say this to me, right? I never had an injury right up to joining Wimbledon in the Premier League. So I don't, you know, I played a lot of games. I must be on maybe 250 games now by the time I'm 23 years old, or 200 games. And the way I play, people know the way I play. I chuck myself into everything. But I never really had an injury. I had a broken finger or a bruised or a dead leg or something. I never had a serious injury. And John Rudge again refined me, ready for this move to the Premier League. Port Vale were Championship. They took me from Lincoln City, and then this move to the Premier League was the dream come true. You know, it'd gone 5 years, Aaron, from being told you weren't good enough to being sold for £2 million to the Premier League. It was just incredible for me. It was just like, wow, or, you know, 6 years maybe, but it was just something that didn't happen. And then when I got to Wimbledon, it was just brilliant. I coming down to London. I've never been down. I think I've been down to London to visit once. Sam Haman took us into the Landmark Hotel in Marylebone, and Joe Kinnear was there, and Dave Barnard, you know, still a close friend of mine. And we signed the contract of a lifetime that a Blackburn boy never dreams of. But, you know, what was to follow was a real tough few years for me.
Before Wimbledon came in, Leeds were in view. They put in a bid of around £1 million. Were you disappointed that Port Vale didn't?
I think Leeds and Spurs. So at the games, Aaron, it was so funny. George Graham would come to the games. David O'Leary would be at the games. And Joe Kinnear was at the games. Obviously, let's call him Sir Joe Kinnear, because what he did for this club, you know, he was brilliant. And it was a really funny story once. The other two sat in the director's box, but Joe came, tried to be incognito, and sat with the fans and put a hat on. This is typical Wimbledon, right? And still got recognised. People were saying, I think Joe Kinnear was sat next to me today. So it's like crazy, because I think each team was saying, well, we're not looking at Gareth Ainsworth, we're not trying to look at him. And there was rumours of Kevin Keegan at Fulham as well, but they were the league below. But eventually, yeah, £2 million, I think Wimbledon paid. And I think Tottenham and Leeds only went to 1 point something. But the club then said to me, Port Vale said, look, we can't turn that down, that sort of money. You know, go and speak to Wimbledon. And that's when we went down and met the aforementioned guys. And yeah, it was brilliant to sign for Wimbledon. Just, that's good to never reach my true potential here. But real good memories.
25 years old, you come to the bright lights of London. What's it like?
Honestly, it was crazy. It really was crazy. I remember driving down. Honestly, lads who have grown up in London or been around London, you're probably used to it, but the tube, it was all like mental to me. The traffic, even the M25 and that. And honestly, I'm from Blackburn, which is like, it's not the biggest city in the world. It's not even a city, it's a town, and there's not much up there. You know, it's a real good place, and you build resilience up all the time because you have to fend for yourself. You know, what you've got is what you've got. We didn't have a lot, and then coming down here, you just, it's like a different world. It's like, honestly, Dick Whittington was probably right. You know, the streets looked like they were paved with gold. It was wow, this is incredible. And then to top it all, I've got this bunch of lads who've got this amazing, amazing team spirit, and going out together was as much as being on the pitch together. And wow, yeah, some experiences for me, you know, we just, I say now that if my boy Kane is at Maidenhead United, he's in their academy there, but if he could relive what I went through, and I went through some tough stuff as well, I'd say yeah, go for it, because I wouldn't change anything. It was brilliant. I really enjoyed it, and I have to say I've been down here ever since, so it's something rubbed off on me.
Absolutely. I want to get on to the teammates, because you arrive at a time where the crazy gang mentality is somewhat at its peak, but it's about to drop. There were some huge names in that dressing room at the time. You think about it, Efan, Marcus Gayle,
Cunningham, Ben Thatcher.
Ben Thatcher's in there, Robbie Neil Earl, Sullivan. Robbie Earl. Yeah. You are dealing with alphas everywhere. Absolutely. I mean, not being funny, your hair wasn't as good back then. You had some real bad buzz cut. But you weren't the Gareth Ainsworth that we know and love now. You were the young boy from Blackburn. How'd you deal with them being in your face?
Honestly, it was a little bit of intrepidation coming down here, because I'd heard about the stories, I'd heard about what they're doing. It was like, but Robbie had come from Port Vale, Robbie Earl, and he was club captain. So automatically, I had sort of an ally there. And he was good, but I still say on this first day that my first day's training, the lads started dropping like flies to the end of the session, I was thinking we're not going to have a team for Saturday here, because it's, you know, there was about five of them got injured on the Thursday, and little did I know that that was just the key for them to go into to the dressing room and get all of my gear that had come in that day and cut it up, set it on fire, and I had to go on with my kit, you know. So that was my baptism, and because I was the new signing, you sort of get the butt of it for a couple of weeks. And I was the record signing for Wimbledon. I think it was the most they'd ever paid for a player, which was a real honour. But then I think about 10 days later, John Hartson walked through the door for about seven and a half million pounds. I'm thinking, right, the jokes are on you, mate. But John was a bit tougher than me, and it was a bit more difficult to get at him. But they still then turned on John. And some of the names we're talking about there, quality lads, really good players, great guys to be around. And the one thing, Aaron, that you knew, that no matter how much stick we gave each other, no matter how many tear-ups were in training or anything, the moment that we were up against an opposition and anything went against us, you know, you had not just 11, you had 30 lads there for you. That was the Wimbledon spirit. That was what we had. And Nobody would outdo us for that, for team spirit, for being on top. And like you say, the crazy gang spirit sort of was taken away a little bit. It should have remained. It should have stayed. That was part of the culture of this club. It was part of what we were. And who cares sometimes that we won game on being a bit tougher than the opposition, or we won game in the tunnel because of the way we'd intimidate the opposition, or because of the way we played, or the way we got forward. It was Wimbledon, and it was brilliant. It was brilliant to play in it. Like I say, it's a real honour to have played for this club, especially in the height of the Premier League.
When people ask me to describe you, obviously, look, there are different words. There's charismatic, you're tenacious, you bring like a certain energy. But I'd say you're unflappable. Nothing ever phases you. And so I can imagine you now, you sat here talking about it with a massive smile on your face. Was it the same back then? Were you sat there when they were cutting up your clothes and setting your clothes on fire, and you're getting in there and you're trying to muck in? Was it a case of, yeah, I'm here, let's just roll with it? Was it a case of show no weakness?
Do you know what? Yeah, definitely show no weakness. If you showed any weakness, they would come at you and come at you more for the thing that you were weak about. Honestly, there was all sorts mentioned, half of the stuff I can't mention on the podcast, but it was a lot. They'd come at you and you would have to stick up for it. The one thing I'd say about myself, and I don't know where it's from, probably from growing up where I did, but adaptability, I will, and I still will now, if something happens right now, I'll adapt to it, and we'll get out of it somehow in a positive way. You know, this is me, this has been my world, and I don't know why, maybe I'm just lucky like that, but I'll energise, I'll lead people, but adaptable. I will make the best of anything at all. I really will, you know, and that's, I don't know whether it's come from not having a great deal growing up, but making the best of everything, but still making the best of everything, going, right, you know, we'll make this, all right, it looks like we're up against it here, but we can do this, we can make this happen, we can work through, there's something, there's definitely, you know, it's something we can exploit here. And we'll, and that, I think I took that into management with me as well as a manager, but definitely as a person. And back then, and I think being part of that crazy gang almost made me even stronger with that resilience and adaptability, you know, because you had to be tough. They weren't going to feel sorry for yourself. You know, they needed you on the pitch, but they weren't going to have somebody who'd just give up at the first sign of trouble. They'd go, right, we need a fighter. And if you're a fighter, we'll fight for you as well. And yeah, it was really brilliant to be part of.
Tell us about the debut at Forest.
Yeah, like I say, moments in your career that you remember. My debut away at Shrewsbury, without a shadow of a doubt, probably being sold for money. That was a big moment for me when somebody actually pays money for you, thinking, wow, somebody's actually willing to part cash for me. That's crazy, you know, you can't imagine that. But then your Premier League debut, and not everyone gets to do it, you know, and a majority of footballers don't get to do it. So I'm very, very lucky. Worked my absolute socks off in the build-up to that moment. And yeah, playing away at Notts Forest in a 2-1 win, first game. And then I think we backed it up with a 1-0 win against Arsenal at home at Selhurst Park, you know. So really, really phenomenal. So I've made my Premier League debut. Just meant everything to me.
What were the characters like behind the scenes? I'd love for you to go into depth telling us about Joe Kinnear, about Terry Burton, about people in and around the football club. I always ask people about Stanley Reid because I think he was just fascinating.
Really, really. Stanley was just that sort of eccentric sort of guy, but he was brilliant to have as a chairman or the president. He was just the history that had been at this club for so many years, you know. He'd seen it all, and he never lowered himself to get involved in some of the antics, but he was just loved it, loved the team spirit. You know, he's a proper, proper guy. Joe Kinnear, for me, the perfect guy to manage the group of players he had, because they could have been out of control with other managers. You know, they could overpower other managers. But Joe, once he spoke to you, you listened. And that's what Joe had. He had total respect from us right from the start. You know, I really, really did. And he was tough to work for, you know. If you did something wrong, he would, in no uncertain terms, give you an absolute hairdryer in the dressing room. Absolutely.
Did you ever get it?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, got it. I got it from Terry as well. Both Terry took over as manager after Joe. But I saw Joe give it to people like Marcus Gayle and you know, even people like Robbie and that, you know, really heated debates and discussions, and he got the best out of us without a shadow of a doubt. Terry Burton, great, brilliant coach, saw the game in a real purist way, but when it needed to be done, Terry would you know, he'd say, right, you've got to put that tackle in, you've got to get that crossing. You know, I'd love to play the perfect football, but at times football's not perfect. You've got to do that. And I remember him giving me a right bollocking at Stockport away once in the Championship, and he told me Terry's responsible for this. And so he at half time, just before half time, I think it was, he came down, and I was having a shocker. I really was. I was having a great game, and he gave me the rollicking of my life from the touchline. Honestly, I could hear him, I could feel his voice saying, are you going to get across? And are you going to get past your man? In different, probably, words than that. Ended up trying so hard that I went past my man trying to get a crossing, and I slammed into the barriers at Stockport and I broke my wrist.
No.
And I was out for 6 weeks after that. And that was, honestly, and the injury probably...
Did he say anything to you afterwards?
No, because it wasn't his fault. It was my fault, because it's so stupid trying to get to a ball that I could never get to. But I'm not sure I would have gone for it without Terry's rollicking on the touchline.
He was only little, though,
yeah,
wasn't
he? Yeah, he was, but he could bite. I tell you, yeah, he could get the best out of you, definitely, Terry. But he'd been here throughout the Joe Kinnear years, you know, the Premier League years and the success. I think they were seventh in the Premier League at one stage and finished, you know, right up there. And yeah, the demise was terrible to see, you know, and unfortunately my time at Wimbledon took me through that, you know, and that was tough to see from the ownership and things like that. But you know, my biggest thing is that the injuries I got, you know, after about 10 games here, Aaron, I started feeling this groin injury that I'd never felt ever. And I eventually got diagnosed with this, I suppose what you'd call it nowadays, this sort of a pubic overload. And maybe, as you said rightly, you know, I played that many games. I never was injured. I never felt anything coming on. But you see these guys, you know, people are out with these pelvic overloads and footballers growing or Gilmore's growing or hernias. That it took me, honestly, I think I was out for about a year and a half with this. And it destroyed me. It really tested my resilience. I remember the club employed a physio called John Clinkard. Can't remember where he was. I think he was been at Oxford before here. And he came in and he made a real impact on me. You know, he's getting on now, John, but he was a top physio all the time. Steve Allen was here, did everything he could to try and send me here, there, and everywhere to people. And I think John was really patient with me. And Steve had to get the first team ready every week, and I was a real long-term case. So John took over me, and he was superb for me, you know, and got me right eventually. And obviously Steve played a big part as well, and both of them got me on the pitch. But by this time, the club had been relegated from the Premier League, and we were in the Championship, so that's where I played the majority of games for this club.
Who told you to get your tooth taken out?
Did you hear about it? What did you hear about that?
I know everything about it. You forget. You know, you were my first ever interview in football. You were someone I always looked up to, and someone who always is always very good to me. So I can't not do you justice.
I didn't mention that then, but I had this groin pain and it wouldn't go away. And this guy in France apparently had a way of removing your wisdom teeth.
Right.
Would relieve your groin pain, right? And apparently, this is not factual, this is rumour, Steven Gerrard had it done around a very similar time to me. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I thought, I was at the end of my tether, and I thought, if he's had it done, I'm going to have mine done. And I think it was a link through an Arsenal physio or something. I went to, honestly, Aaron, this is the craziest story you've ever seen. I go to France, so to go and see this French doctor who was highly recommended. I think the Arsenal Wenger connection and all this lot. I turn up in France. I get told to go to this place for 2 days. So I turn up in France. And this is the days before mobile phones, by the way. You had to read maps and things, all right? This is like, there's no Google Maps. And
Master Atlas of Waze Paris. Or
like that. So I turn up at this place, and it's down this back street in Paris, and I'm thinking, my God. So I go in this dentist. This guy comes out and says, open your mouth, like very, very broken English. So I'm not my. He went, there's the problem. And I thought, what? He went, like, your wisdom teeth. Come back tomorrow and we'll remove your wisdom teeth. And I thought, what? Like, seriously? So I'm in France, right? I'm not speaking a word of French. So French is horrendous. His English wasn't great by any means at all, right? So the next day I come back to the same place. I go upstairs and no word of a lie, Aaron, honestly. This guy then puts me in the chair. I don't think there's much sort of sterilization here anyway. But what he picks up from the side of the table is what I can only say is a pair of pliers, right? I'm sure they must have been medical pliers, but honestly, I don't think they had Rolson written on them or something. Or other brands are available. I don't know what they were, right? But he picked up a pair of pliers, put them in my mouth, honestly, got his knee on my chest. And this, I promise you, this is true. True story. He's gripped one of my wisdom teeth and he's pulled it. And unbelievably, the thing came out right, and it went like bump, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to be so good. That was so easy. I'm expecting the worst here, right? He's just pulled it straight out, right? I thought, great. And it's a big thing. Have you seen the roots on these things? They're massive, by the way. The roots on wisdom teeth, they're huge, right? They're thinking, how far is this going to move on? He then moves to the other side, right? Gets the pliers, same method, grips my teeth, and this is no word of a lie, right? Grips the wisdom tooth, knee on my chest, ready to pull. He's pulling and it's not moving, right? This wisdom tooth. And he's holding the pliers that tight. The tooth then shatters in my mouth. So The players then break the tooth, and he speaks no English, but anyone in the world will be able to translate this. He went, uh-oh. I swear to you. And I'm thinking, what do you mean, uh-oh? Like, you've got players in my mouth here. This tooth is shattered now, so there's nothing to get hold of. So then he puts the players down, picks up a scalpel, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this has gone on a bad turn. I've got three teeth left here to bring out. He's got the first one out, that's fine. And it's his monster tooth. I'm thinking, he's going to start digging these roots out of this. And honestly, I was in there four hours. This is, reliving this is brilliant. So 3 or 4 hours go by. I'm injected for fun. I can hardly lift my jaw now because of the injections. Never mind it. I get back to the hotel and they said something like room number. And so I get in the room number hotel. Anyway, I'm groggy as anything. I feel like I've had open heart surgery, never mind wisdom teeth. They come that night, there's two of them, two of these guys, they come this night, they give me two tablets and said, take this one now and take this one in an hour and you'll fly home tomorrow. I'm thinking, is this it? Is this the aftercare, right? So anyway, I'm feeling horrendous. I've got, like I say, I think my jaw's massive and I take one tablet, I take the next tablet. I go to sleep, I wake up the next morning, I feel absolutely brand new. I feel absolutely fantastic. I'm thinking, what have they given me? Right? I've got massive holes. I still feel them to this day. I feel the holes. Like, I always remember that. I put my tongue there going, massive holes. But I felt brand new. Flew home. And the best part of the story is 3 months later, I'm back on the pitch. Now, whether it's the wisdom teeth or whether it was John Clincard, I'd like to say it was John who spent so many years and patience with me and doing. But I was back on the pitch within probably 3 months playing again. And to this day, I've never had groin pain again. But I would not recommend. I don't even know where I went. I don't know who it was. But I was back on the pitch. And that is certainly a story that I'll never forget.
Who recommended you go to him?
We got to the end of the tether at Wimbledon. I think there was a link with maybe Arsenal. I can't remember, but there was definitely a French link with the club. This doctor had done so much work with other players and got them fit through these methods. And listen, I got back on the pitch. So that's all I cared about. But I wouldn't... when I say about my son going through the life I had, everything, maybe apart from that. That was horrendous, that was.
We don't realise he was a dentist, but also a part-time gas fitter. Like, I mean, that is mad.
Can you have a look at my car?
That's
as
one
well,
of the
mate.
Maddest stories I've ever heard.
And honestly, not a word of a lie. That is so true. And I always remember him going, uh-oh. That was the biggest moment. I'm thinking, what do you mean, uh-oh?
That is the maddest thing I've ever heard in my life. Take me back to March the 3rd, 1999. Wimbledon beat Sheffield Wednesday away at Hillsborough. But before the game, Joe Kinnear suffers a heart attack. And we don't know what happens. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen after that. But Wimbledon don't win a game for the rest of the season. Yeah. And it culminates in Joe leaving the club. Tell me about that day.
Yeah, I wasn't in the squad that day, but I was up there. And I just remember, I think Joe was he was feeling a bit rough, and I think he thought he had indigestion. So obviously, I think we've all heard the stories of people thinking that, and they've actually had a heart attack. But the doc there on the day, I think diagnosed it pretty quickly, which is something that obviously lucky in football to have. You know, look at the Tom Lockyer thing. It's probably a million miles away from the Joe Kinnear thing years ago, but in football we've always got good medical people around us and emergency services on the goal. And so Joe, yeah, he obviously we were told he'd suffered a heart attack, and for me that was a massive blow because I think Joe would have kept us in the Premier League. Joe would have cemented what he built, you know, and he was in charge of everything. He was in charge of absolutely everything. He was a real leader, charismatic guy, you know, and I know lately, you know, his health's been in a little bit of suffering, but for me, even though I didn't play for him a great deal, you know, one of the greatest managers that I've ever played for, without a doubt, and a massive loss, you know, when he went. I think there was no one really stepping into the shoes that Joe had left, and it was a tough time for the club. And on top of that, obviously the transition sort of came with the ownership and rumours here, there, and everywhere after that. But yeah, massive moment that was for me in Wimbledon's Premier League sort of status.
Tell me about the nickname Wild Thing, because
that came at Wimbledon.
It emanated from Wimbledon, doesn't
it? Yeah, it came from Wimbledon.
Was it Kenny Cunningham?
It was Kenny Cunningham, Marcus Gayle, and Carl Leeburn. So we were on a pre-season tour somewhere. I can't remember. I think we were down south, down. I think Nigel Mansell once had a hotel down in the southwest somewhere. And this is another crazy story, Mary, but I think he did. And teams used to go down there and stay, and he had a football pitch and all this sort of stuff. There was a big racing museum, I remember, underneath at the bottom of the hotel or next to the hotel. And anyway, we went down there, and one day off during pre-season, which was tough, by the way. It was tough pre-seasons. We used to run and run and run until we were chucking up sometimes. But there was a day off and a game of golf. And anyone who's seen me play golf, and my golf buddies, if they're listening to this, will be laughing now. If you ever play golf with me, don't watch me, because I will put you off your game. You've got no chance of me. I've got the quickest, shortest swing you've ever seen. I'm like playing baseball. and I have to aim so far left, because I've got this great power fade that will come, it'll come back eventually. People are like, guys, where are you aiming? Where are you aiming? And I'll say, watch this. And it'll just fade back around. Anyway, renting clubs and I think me and Kenny were playing a hole, and Carl and Gailey were behind us on the tee. And they've seen it, and they just, I think I almost killed Kenny, or almost hit the golf buggy or something. And they just started going, Wild Thing. Like, that is the nickname from Wild Thing. And I think it probably came as well with the way I trained, the way I played, the way I looked. But that was it. That's where it came from. And then I remember the public address system at Wimbledon used to play my song when I'd scored, or when I came on a sub, or when I came off. They'd play Wild Thing over the tannoy, and it was... Yeah, it stuck.
Do you like it?
I kind of liked it, you know, yeah.
Do you like it now?
There's worse nicknames. Yeah, Wild Thing's quite cool, because I have had my moments. I'm not your normal run-of-the-mill sort of guy, you know. I will try and push it into the edge all the time. And people know that about me. People know that about me. I'll do it in everything I do, but I will go to the nth degree to try and... put it this way. If we're on a night out, I'm never the one who says, should we get a taxi on now? I'm never that one. I'm always the one going, where's the next party? What can we do? How far can we push this? Where can we go? I love it. I think life's for living. I really do. And when you see me on the side of the football pitch, or on the football pitch, and it's become crazy, hasn't it? It's like, it used to be the more effort you gave, the better you were. Now sometimes people giving loads of effort are ridiculed. And I'm like, Why has it suddenly got to this where you're not cool if you're trying too hard?
Mm.
I just give everything and everything and everything, and I always will. And I think that probably can tip over into a few wild moments, and that's probably where the nickname sticks. And I'm proud of it. You know, I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of taking everything to the limit. I really am. And hopefully it keep going. You know, I'm not getting older, but still got a smile on my face, still ready to go.
Who are your closest friends in the dressing room?
Kenny was a good guy. Kenny was a real good guy, you know. Trond Andersen, when he signed from Norway. Obviously,
you were in a band with him, weren't you?
Connection there, yeah. So Trond was a brilliant
guy. APA?
APA, me, Trond, and the groundsman Chris Perry. Not the Chris Perry, it was the groundsman Chris Perry. So they had the same name. But everyone then thought it was Chris Perry. So
how did you think about getting a band together?
Well, I'd always been in bands, you know. My mum was a singer growing up, so up north, and she used to sing in a big mecca halls and that. We used to go and watch gigs and things, so that's how she made a living. And so I'd always been in bands. She'd always taught me to sing and music, taught me to breathe, really. People can sing, but you have to breathe right and everything. So I've always been in bands, and then it sort of went when I came down to London. So me and Trond, I saw him taking a guitar to an away trip once. I said, you play guitar? He went, yeah. I went into his room, and he's... Can he play a guitar, by the way? Wow, what a guitarist he was. So we found out that Chris Perry, the old groundsman, was the ex-drummer of Jericho, which was a 60s band, which was like 70s, 60s, 70s, but a really decent band. We said, should we get a band together? And we played a couple of the Wimbledon Christmas days and that. The band was like the famous Christmas parties that Wimbledon used to have. I can say that I played a gig there a couple of times.
Any chance of APA doing a one-off here at Power Lane?
Well, I don't know where Chris is. He was in Rains Park, so if he's still around, it'd be great to see him. Tron's over in Norway.
We can make something happen.
I'd be up for it. Yeah, definitely. Get the club to put something together. We'll play on the pitch.
Yeah. You've got a band at the moment. You're in a band.
Yeah, so the band at the moment, the Cold-Blooded Hearts. Yeah, so website, coldbloodedhearts.com if people want to get on there. But we've got a gig in Camden, Aaron, 29th, Good Friday. We're playing the Black Hearts. We're supporting San Vito Ryder, who's releasing an EP. We are supporting with a support band there, and it's the first time we're going to go out there and play our album. So all original stuff. Looking forward to that. So at the moment, ramping up to that, you know, 29th of March in the Black Heart Camden. That'd be great. Get yourselves down there, and if not, Aaron will put together a gig on the Wimbledon pitch.
That'd be good. We've got plenty of space here.
Come on, let's do it. I'm up for it. If you can get us playing on this pitch, let's do it.
Got loads of space for you.
It's the Cherry Red Records Stadium as well.
100%.
It works.
Yeah.
That's our record label. Come on.
Just looking at the back end of the 90s, the club takes a very Norwegian feel. We know that Sam the Man leaves and things go in a funny direction. But Egil Olsen comes in to replace Joe Kinnear. Look, he'd had success with the Norwegian national team, but that was pretty much it. And there were a few lads who weren't really enthused by him, his methods, didn't feel that he maybe was the calibre of coach that they'd wanted for the football club. I call him all Wellington boots, and that's pretty much it. But you barely play any football.
Yeah, I didn't really play. I was injured around that time, you know. What I will say is my greatest ever Premier League moments came when Egil was manager, and that was the two goals up at Newcastle. Mm. You know, I'll never forget that. Mick Harford can take a big credit for that, because we were 3-1 down up at Newcastle. I'm sub. And Egil looked at me and said, "You go on." And I've gone, "All right." Honestly, that's how it came about, really. And then Mick's gone, "You better go and get changed." So I get warmed up, got changed, and I come on the pitch about 70 minutes or something. And I said to Mick, "Where am I playing, Mick?" And he went, "I don't really know." He went, "I'll tell you what, just go out there and cause havoc." And I went and scored two goals. So that is old school. So I sort of played on the lefty shorter wing and up front a little bit, and scored two goals up there, and we drew 3-3. So Newcastle fans, and I think Ruud Hullett, well, I know Ruud Hullett was manager, and I think they either drew or got beat with Sunderland 3 days later, and he went. So I think that was the demise of Ruud Hullett, but my sort of finest hour on a Premier League pitch. But to answer your question, Egil was, I think the change was huge from Joe to Egil was just a mountain away. It was, you know, he was quiet, very softly spoken, real thinker, real sort of introvert, Egil, you know. And when you're coming into that dressing room with the characters we had, the people we had, they needed to be a leader, they need to be led, they need to be enthused by somebody. And Egil, you know, I don't want to speak bad about him. No, never want to speak bad about anyone. You know, this life's hard enough without people. But probably, yeah, just a bit too much the Premier League for him, you know, and not knowing it, coming into it like he did. Unbelievable success with Norway, you know, unbelievable. But again, not speaking the language and all these things coming into it, you know. But he was a great guy. I'd still have a beer with him now. You know, he's obviously, you know, we got relegated at the end of that season. Again, I was cropped up with an ankle injury, I think it was Southampton away, I think the last game of the Premier League, wasn't it? And I remember people at Ards, you know, almost in tears, and Dean Blackwell, and real close friends of mine in that dressing room. I felt for him, you know, Kenny.
How did you feel? Because you didn't play a big part. You were...
A bit guilty, mate, that I hadn't contributed. Bit guilty that they'd spent so much money on me, and I was the next best thing coming through. And honestly, I was gutted, because I had international rumours about me. Kevin Keegan, like I say, was the manager of England at the time, and he called me up, said, "Look, if you sign for Fulham, you know, you there's a chance you're going to get in this national team as well, and you're doing really well." And I'm like, I was close to it, you know. And I always say that maybe it just wasn't meant for me, or maybe that wasn't my path. But I felt a little bit, I felt guilty, honestly, and all the Wimbledon fans and all the Wimbledon teammates and board members. And, you know, one of the best people was Dave Barnard. He never once made me feel like I'd done anything wrong. He always said, no, that happens in football, you know, people get injured. And genuinely, I was devastated that I hadn't contributed, because I'd done all that. I'd done all the graft in those lower leagues to get where I got to. And it just never materialised from in the Premier League, you know, and that's big. I've played Chelsea, and I played at, you know, played at a lot of the grounds, Man United at home, with, you know, on the pit, on the bench and the pitch, and so massive experiences that people will only dream of getting. But still, I wanted to be in week in, week out. I wanted to be that stalwart. I wanted to be that right winger that people were talking about on Match of the Day every Saturday night. But never happened. But I think people then saw what I could give, because I came back into the Championship. And really, you know, we had a decent side. We made a decent go for a couple of years. And I moved on to Cardiff City, with Sam Hammond had gone there. And by this time, obviously, the rumours of moving up the road were rife. And
How were they not rife when you were there? Because you were still in and around the club for a while.
I was in and around the club for a while. And, you know, yeah, it was tough. Looking back as an older person, you probably look and see what a huge, huge mistake that was, you know, for rips the heart out of people, you know. It really does, you know, move like that. But again, you know, MK, big time, they wanted their club. Would have been, I guess it started their own club, would have been nice. But, you know, this is Wimbledon. When I look out and I see the, you know, the badge of the real Wimbledon, this is the Wimbledon I played for. Because those fans that started this club were the fans that cheered me on, were the fans that laughed when I tried to tackle someone with my head on the pitch, or they were the fans that that went through all that carnage, you know. So this is the real women, and this is where it is, and I'll always remember that, you know. Although, you know, I'm not going to hate the other club. They just exist, and that's them, you know. But this is, you know, like I say, life's really tough, and to have these feelings in your bitterness or not. Or a hatred and things like that, it's not nice to have them harboring in you. Just get rid of them. I'm just proud of this club. This, you know, when I look and everything's blue and yellow in that stand, I'm just looking now, and it's just, that's the kit I played for, you know, that's the Wimbledon that I played for. You know, we were talking about the sponsorships earlier, with I signed, I think it was Allenex, but Tiny came in, and I remember Carl Lieben, 6'5", wearing a kit that said Tiny on it. It's such a laugh. We're all taking the mick one out of that.
That was my first computer.
Was it? Yeah. Tiny computer. Tiny. I remember that. Yeah,
they used to have a slogan, think big about your PC, think tiny.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very catchy. Good. Yeah, it's very catchy, good. They then went out of business.
And then they put it on the front of Carl Lieben, and it looked silly, yeah. Because it was massive. But no, we had some great times. We had some really good times, like I say. But as I say, for me, the heart will always be here, Plough Lane. I never actually played at Plough Lane. Not many did. You know, it went before we all came at that club. But they always talked about it. Even when I was at Selhurst, and even when I played out at Plough, there was stories about Plough Lane. There was always the stories about Plough Lane, how tough it was. And I think Dean Blackwell had probably played there. I think he was the longest. Neil Ardley maybe had a game there. So, but they used to talk about, oh, Plough Lane, back to Plough Lane. We took them back to Plough Lane. And I always thought, oh, I wish. It just sounds cool, doesn't it? I wish I'd have been at Plough Lane. But
You're here now.
You never know. Like I say, I've scored in that end, so really proud of that. But I don't think the keeper was that mobile. So,
do you ever feel that you've got unfinished business with this club? You talk about, you know, costing the club money, and that was a long time ago, and you being a really expensive signing and maybe not paying your way effectively. Do you feel you've got unfinished business here? Because you've always had this weird sort of respect. I remember you came here with Wickham Wanderers. 2-1-1, and you talk quite extensively to the media after the game about your love for the football club and what it was going through at the time.
Yeah, I understand. As I say, as I got older, Aaron, I probably understand more and more now what they went through, you know, and to bring it back from the brink. And people, like Dave Barnard, you know, he's been a big fan and big part of it. And, you know, Ian is the Cherry Reds guy as well. They've just really proved that you can do it. Massive respect for him, you know, real respect. As the question of unfinished business, I don't think I've got anything to pay back because I really gave everything I could. I wouldn't ever not give everything, you know. I know they paid a big fee for me and obviously the wages were good in the Premier League and everything, bloody blah, as football were, but, you know, I never for once thought I'm stealing a living. I really gave everything. I gave my absolute all to try. I had an ankle operation recently, a fusion of my ankle. I remember playing through pain in my ankle just because I thought, oh my God, Gareth, you missed so much injury. You missed so many games with that groin injury. And my ankle was knackered at times. I really did. But I played through the pain because I thought, I can't be injured again here. These fans are going to think I'm just on a jolly up. So, you know, what the future holds, who knows, you know. The club have done brilliant. And just outside the playoffs at the moment, wow, we've got an exciting time, you know, an exciting finish to the season. They've proved they're really good. You know, they've stuck by Neil when he went through some tough times, a good teammate of mine. I was so pleased when he got him up and got him. Bayo speaks very, very highly of the club, you know, all the time. He says some real brilliant people through the doors, and none more than Ali Alhamidi, who I can safely say that I sold to Wimbledon. You know, it was perfect for Ali, absolutely perfect, and they properly looked after him and moved him on. And what a player he's going to become. But yeah, exciting times. Gave my absolute all for this club, and I always will for whatever club I'm at. Real great memories there.
What does the future hold?
Yeah, we'll see. I'm happy enough to say I've turned a couple of jobs down, but they were very soon after QPR, and honestly, for 34 years from when we talked about 16-year-old signing at Blackburn there, apart from that sort of Northwichy Preston bit, I've never been out of the game. I've never been out of the game for 34 years. You know, I'm 50 now, and I've loved it. I've loved every single minute. But I also loved Christmas at Mum and Dad's, back to Blackburn. This Christmas has just gone. Never done that before, ever. Never spent Blackburn Christmas in Blackburn. And since I was there, and so that was nice. School runs are something that I'm not used to, and I'm getting used to this traffic in the mornings and scrapping with all the drivers trying to get your kids to school and pick them up from school.
You drive a Mustang, don't you?
I drive a Mustang, so the kids are loving getting dropped off at school in a Mustang at the moment. But I will have to say that it's high time the itchy feet have started. I know what I've got to offer. I was looking at Wycombe Wanderers getting to Wembley last night. Fantastic, Matt Bloomfield. What a job he's done there in the EFL trophy there. And that's the fourth time in 9 years that Wycombe went to Wembley. And then I'm thinking, I'm so proud that we reached three playoff finals with them. You know, we got to the championship with a team like Wycombe Wanderers. Proud of keeping QPR up last year. I know what I've got to offer in football. I know. I can make it successful wherever I go. Just the right club, the right time. To do that again with another club will be absolutely phenomenal. And I believe I can. I don't think it's too difficult to get a group of players all scrapping and fighting the crazy gang way, if you will, at times, you know. But there's more to it than just the tactics. There's the heart, there's this togetherness, there's this soul that I thrived off as a manager. I really did. And I'm ready. I'm ready to get back in. There's been a couple of calls abroad as well. But also, when you talk about getting back in, you also talk about the horrible thing of people losing their jobs, you know, and that comes with it. So, you know, you've got to be careful as a manager out of work. I'm enjoying the TV work and the radio stuff, and thank you very much for some of that as well, mate. But we are definitely now looking at getting back in the game and proving once again that these sleeping giants can upset some of the big boys. It's the best feeling in the world at times.
Well, don't forget, this is always home. You're always welcome here.
Thank you.
We love you very much, Ian, and really appreciate your time joining us at Plough Lane. Thank you for joining us on the official Wimbledon podcast.
Absolute pleasure. And to all you Wimbledon fans out there who stuck by me and supported me throughout the years, thank you so much. You know, it's been a real pleasure playing for this club, and hopefully there's many successes to come.
Hi, I'm Harry Pell. Get every single episode of the official AFC Wimbledon podcast the minute it drops. Just head over to Acast, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts and hit subscribe. Come on, you Dons.